Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our first book club pick of 2024, Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City, a memoir by Jane Wong. As always, the Books and Boba podcast is supported in part by our listeners at patreon.com/booksandboba. So if you'd like to support this podcast, you can head on over and become a member. Patreon supporters get access to Books and Boba's members-only Discord server, where you can talk to us and fellow book club members in real time, as well as our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, where Rhea, myself, and sometimes a guest have a casual chat about what's going on in our lives, books and otherwise. So yeah, we are at the end of January, and man, it feels like it's been a really long month.
Yeah, same here. It really felt like we were already into April, and I'm like, no, first quarter has not ended. It has barely begun.
Yeah, definitely a lot's been going on. But on the bright side, our pipeline is full. We have a lot of really cool stuff coming up this year for Books and Boba, and we're excited to, you know, bring you a lot more author chats and more programs for you and for our Patreon subscribers as well.
Yeah, like yesterday, I like checked my inbox and it was like 10 emails from Marvin, and they were all like Google Calendar invites for a future author interviews. And I was like, dang, like,
yeah,
we have like author interviews until like March. Yeah, April.
We're booked up till April, which means lots of great content coming your way. Really excited, but at the same time, man, I think we literally just assigned ourselves up for reading like 12 books over the next like 3 months.
Yeah,
so yeah, super excited to be bringing you some exciting content over the next few months. Look forward to it. But we're not here to talk about our plans this year. We are here to discuss our January book club pick. And as always, during our book club discussion, we do go into all plot details of our books. Probably a little less relevant with this book being a memoir, but we will be going in depth into Jane's stories and themes. So if you haven't finished the book yet, now's your chance to hit pause and finish reading. Or if you're one of our readers, I know you're out there, who likes to read our book club picks after listening to our discussion, you're free to do that as well. Read however you like.
And also just some trigger warnings for those of you who have not read the book yet. So we have gambling addiction, alcoholism, portrayals of domestic violence and abusive relationships. So really go into the book just bracing yourself for those. And yeah, just proceed with caution if any of those are your triggers.
Yeah. But with that, let's get started with our book club discussion. Rira, as always, please start us off with the book jacket description of Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City.
In her debut memoir, Jane Wong tells a new story about Atlantic City, one that resists a single identity, a single story, as she writes about making do with what you have and what you don't. What does it mean, she asks, to be both tender and angry? What is strength without vulnerability and humor? Filled with beauty found in unexpected places, Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City is a resounding love song of the Asian American working class, a portrait of how we become who we are, and a story of lyric wisdom to hold and to share. So Jane Wong is a poet, and it is very clear from her prose that she is a poet, and a very good one.
Yeah, her writing definitely has a very lyrical quality to it. It's very evocative. You definitely feel a lot of her emotions as she writes about her experiences growing up in Atlantic City and existing in a lot of these very white male spaces, right? And her background as a poet definitely comes through, because, you know, she weaves in a lot of really great metaphor and wordplay. And I found her story really interesting to read, both because of the content and because of her style.
Yeah, she has, I think, two other books that came out before this, and they were poetry collections. And some of the poems that she's written, it's expanded upon in this collection of essays. I personally want to read How to Not Be Afraid of Everything, because there is a chapter where she talks about hypervigilance that Asian Americans with, trauma, and also like Asian American women just navigating a patriarchal world kind of feel. And she also goes into her panic attacks and her anxiety and how she deals with it. So I would love to read her previous book and see, because that is a topic that I am pretty interested in. But this collection of essays, because it is a collection of essays, I would say they're like vignettes, because there are like mini chapters within chapters. And from interviews that I've read with Jane Wong, she said that she didn't write these chronologically. She didn't really think about writing linearly. And some of the writing in her book, she's been working on since like 2015. So there's just like bits and pieces that she pulled out from previous writings. And then obviously, she goes into her experience into the pandemic. So there's like more recent works. So I really like the nonlinear quality of the book, which is usually rare for me as a reader.
Yeah. I mean, even though the stories don't take place during a linear timeline, they still flowed really well into each other and built off each other as we went along. Like, it was a good progression of stories. And you know, for me, it was a really great reminder that the Asian American experience, and specifically the Chinese American experience, isn't a monolith, right? Like, I share a couple intersections with Jane, right? We're both Chinese Americans, children of immigrants. But there are other intersections that I don't share with her, right? Like, I'm a dude. I grew up on the West Coast, specifically the San Gabriel Valley, within an Asian American enclave. So growing up, I didn't have the experience of feeling ostracized because of, you know, my ethnicity. There are other reasons that I was ostracized, mainly, you know, my choices, my hobbies, my lifestyle. But I think it's good to be reminded that even within cultures and subcultures, experiences vary widely based on where, when, and how you were raised.
Yeah, just from reading the premise of this book, because it does go into her father, who had a gambling addiction, who would go to Atlantic City, and at some point he loses a lot of money and he leaves the family, right? So from reading the premise, you think that this is kind of going to be one of those stories where it's about overcoming trauma and it's going to be like a sad time book. But actually, this book is quite funny. And I think it kind of holds like a reverse Uno card, because it's like, you thought that this was going to be like an immigrant struggle book with a lot of sad time stuff. But actually, there's joy in it. I love the fact that she has like this really tight relationship with her mother and also like with her brother. And it's also about how she came into her own in writing. And it's like, it's more than just her abusive relationship with her father, and also disappointing relationships with like her past partners. So it goes beyond trauma. And I think she does mention it in her book. She writes, "They're so hungry for immigrant trauma, they lap at blood before blood can even exist. But isn't love mine to hold to? This shimmering dip in the heart, this rattling terror? Wasn't it some kind of love that led my mother to cross that shore? Isn't love what siphons nourishment to the organs? As a Chinese American woman, as a child of immigrants, how can I divorce my experiences from love and fetish, terror, and hypersexualized violence? Like, she does go into like there is this subgenre of of like trauma porn in Asian American literature.
I mean, we've read our fair share of those types of stories, right? Like, you know, for this book club, we've made a conscious effort to read a diverse spread of genres. But, you know, growing up, if we were ever assigned a book by an Asian American in school, it was probably one of these, you know, intergenerational trauma porn stories about, you know, mother and daughters and whatnot, right?
Yeah. I mean, mother and daughter relationships in Asian immigrant households, I think it is like a very special type of relationship that has a lot of that has a lot of pain, but also a lot of love at the same time. But we have read books with a lot of portrayals of intergenerational trauma and the immigrant struggle and the broken American dream. And those books are very important. However, I feel like as time has gone on and as like the Asian American literature collection has grown over the past few years, like, we want to branch out of that stereotype of like, we're always suffering. It's like, no, some of us, you know, some of us actually have okay relationships with our family. And some of us actually do, like, we want to read stories that are about like falling in love and, you know, defeating empires. Like, it's like very frustrating when non-Asian readers, they are actively seeking trauma porn stories or there are Asian authors who are querying and that is the only thing that literary agents are looking for. And Jane goes into a lot of that in her book on like, there's like this one story where she's talking about how like someone asked her to read a poem about like her struggles and she was like, no thanks. And then the lady came back and was like, okay, but like, can you maybe send me your poem and we'll have someone else read it? And it's like, wow, people are really that interchangeable for for immigrant pain.
Yeah. And maybe it's because I just finished reading the book recently, but I'm reminded of the anecdote she had when attending Kuniman for the first time and being overwhelmed and kind of having a panic attack, right? Because of the solidarity she was feeling for the first time. Because for the longest time, you know, coming up as a writer and going through grad school and everything, she's been indoctrinated into believing that there's only room for one, everyone's competing against each other. And when she finally finds herself in a room full of other Asian American writers who are nothing but supportive, she was still super tense about it, right?
Yeah, she studied at the Iowa Writings Workshop, and that's a very prestigious writing workshop. If you tell anyone that you graduated from that program, they're just like, wow, you're like one of the best writers in America, pretty much. And I was pretty surprised to read about like the, not the red tape necessarily, but just like the amount of entitlement from the professors and how, you know, dismissive they were of Jane's writing, and also just like, you know, calling her poetry like cheap IKEA furniture that doesn't come with directions. And I was like, holy crap, like as someone who went to who graduated from a writing program, albeit it was screenwriting, like I've never received critique that useless and that scathing. My professors actually did give feedback like that. Like they actually did write comments. And the fact that she didn't get comments from her professor because they didn't find her to be a promising writer and they didn't like her work, I was like, what the hell? Like, you would think that like once you get into this program, like you would be shown at least a modicum of respect because you were good enough to get accepted into the program. And just like reading about Jane's kind of abusive relationship with the white professors in this program, it was really hard to read.
Yeah, and I mean, they kind of fueled her imposter syndrome. She was already feeling like she lucked into getting there, and then just being bombarded with this constant reaffirmation of her, like, maybe she shouldn't be here. I mean, I don't know if I could have persevered through that. Like, it seems very... And I guess that's something we see a lot throughout this memoir, right? Is she goes through a lot of shit, you know, some through her own choices, but a lot of it is due to the environments that she finds herself in, right? Like being poor and Chinese, growing up in New Jersey, being Asian in very white spaces, and how those power imbalances affect her both personally and professionally. And the silver lining in, you know, all these stories is that she never really gives up, right? Like, she's able to persevere through all that. And that's not nothing, right? Because as we know, this world it's built to beat us down.
Yeah. And I feel like academia, it is kind of like that is kind of the packaged American dream for immigrant parents, right? You go into a prestigious school and, you know, you make sure that the next generation can claw themselves out of poverty. They can like move up in the world. But academia is like, it is very biased, and not just towards like race, but also economic status. You know, it's like, if you're not rich, if you're not part of like if you're working like a job while you are studying, then you don't belong there because you're not taking your craft seriously. You're not doing it like 100% because your attention is being split. And Jane is constantly belittled and judged during her time in Iowa. And also, it's like very sad because, you know, she's in a community where she's like one of the only Asian people there. And that is still kind of like a shock from moving from Jersey, even though, you know, Jersey is not like San Gabriel Valley. There's still a very sizable Asian community there. There are a lot of enclaves. And just to be uprooted and just put in this very hostile place that's constantly gaslighting you, saying like, hey, you're a token. Like, you are taking somebody else's space because like they need to fill their quota. And it's really heartbreaking to read because she was so excited to get into this program.
Yeah, I feel like being gaslit is kind of, it's an ongoing theme, right? Like, the whole world is kind of gaslighting her all the time. And, you know, reading all that she went through, you know, professionally, personally, romantically, it's kind of hard not to, you know, feel pity sometimes because, man, it just seems like she just can't catch a break. But like we mentioned up top, this book isn't really a sad times book at all. And I think Jane does a good job kind of weaving through the tones that, you know, even though you're reading about all this really heinous stuff that's happening to her, she also invokes this feeling of just like anger and rage, right? Like, she's, you know, she spends the book alternating between feeling sad for herself and feeling angry about everything. And I think the book does a really good job balancing those two modes.
Yeah. A big theme in this book is rage and anger and how it can fuel you, but also really exhaust you, and how empathy can also be extinguished by exhaustion. There's only so many times you can give somebody a second, third, fourth chance. And like her essay, Object of Love, which goes into her past abusive relationships, you know, like, there is this passage that I thought was very powerful. And she wrote, "I am beginning to believe that difficult means independent. Let me say that more accurately. I am worried that being a difficult woman means I love myself. I love my convictions, my community, my writing, my intelligence, my gut, and all its flora. And every single time I feel like I have to lessen myself because of men, I am difficult. Let me say that again. I am scared that being difficult means I want to survive. I want to survive." And I do like how, you know, even though she is writing about like these horrible experiences with her ex-partners, it doesn't veer into trauma porn, you know? Like, she doesn't try to make sense of it, because it's like, this is just what happened, and violence doesn't really have a reason. Abuse doesn't really have a root to rationality. And I don't know, like, it seemed very like straightforward and very like raw and honest to me, rather than like, I don't know, it could have been really easy to dramatize her like past trauma in these relationships, but it was like very, like very much like, let me tell you my story.
Yeah, I mean, those, that chapter especially, and whenever she talks about her past relationships, were really hard to get through sometimes, because of just all the, not only micro, but also macro aggressions that she has to go through. And there's that really interesting passage where she talks about how, you know, even though most of her exes have been white, the few exes that weren't white are probably the few that she stayed friends with afterwards. And, you know, really makes you think about how, you know, racial power dynamics play in interracial relationships, in addition to all, you know, your standard patriarchy related stuff too.
I think when you are a woman, you're kind of taught to, you know, make yourself smaller, and kind of, you know, we're conditioned to put other people's need before our own and feel guilty when, you know, we deem to be selfish, I guess, selfish as in quotes. And, you know, there's this idea that, you know, you have to stay through bad situations. You have to, you know, endure cruelty as like a sign of commitment, as a sign of loyalty and love. But love is not that. Loving someone should be easy. It should be as natural as breathing. And, you know, I love that she has such a strong support network, such good friends who remind her like, hey, like, you're my friend and I love you. And this does not come with like a condition. Whereas with her ex-partners, you know, they are like very much, they very much like make her feel like she has to do certain things in order to earn their love. And I'm like, your love is garbage. It's not even love. And the fact that like her ex-partners had like this weird Asian fetish as well, as someone who has been dating a white partner for over 10 years, let me just say that when Dan asked me out, I like immediately went to Facebook to look at his, to look at past exes, just so like, I just needed to check that he wasn't one of those guys. Right. And I thought it was really funny how Jane mentions, Disorientation, which is by Elaine Tse Chow, because there's also like white characters who are into Asian girls, and there's like this fetishness. And the main character says, even if they don't have any Asian exes, there's always this fear that you're going to be the gateway into that like fetishness. And I was just like, yeah, that is a quite valid fear. But I'm kind of like going off on a tangent.
I mean, it was frustrating as a reader to read her going through all those experiences and not just immediately piecing out. And obviously it's different when you're in that situation. It's different when you have a different mindset about your own worth. But, you know, we're reading her memoir, and, you know, because we're she's sharing all of her innermost thoughts, like, we feel like, yeah, like we're friends with her, because we're in this experience together. And just reading about her experiences, especially with, you know, the one she calls the bad one, it's like we've all taken the role of like her friends who are just watching someone we care about be stuck in an abusive relationship, and just wishing, hoping that she would, you know, snap out of it somehow, right?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to fall into the trap of victim blaming, and also, you know, like saying, oh, she has daddy issues, which is why she has a string of bad relationships. But it's not that, though. It's very different when you are in an abusive relationship, especially with a narcissistic partner, because they have this tactic of making you feel like you're special, and they love bomb you, and they take that love away and try to like condition you into doing what they want in order to get that affection. And I think in that essay, she talks about like, she's like, I can't tell you what made me leave. Like, what was the last straw on the camel's back? Like, I can't tell you how I survived that relationship, but, you know, she did. And as someone who had friends in really bad relationships, in abusive relationships, it is, you can tell them all the red flags you want, but they have to be the ones who acknowledge those themselves. They need to be able to value themselves and to be able to say, like, hey, this is not what I deserve. And that's really hard when you come from a place where you have a lot of self-loathing and you feel like you have imposter syndrome and you have to earn somebody's love.
I mean, I feel like, so this is where I don't share an intersection with Jane, which is like feeling like you have to conform or change yourself to fit in, right? Like, I personally didn't have to do that because, like, I always grew up in majority Asian places and I didn't have a lunchbox moment. She mentioned her lunchbox moment in one of her essays as well, which is like, you know, the experience of going, bring your lunch to school and having everyone like be grossed out by it. Like, it's what the media is trying to tell me is a quintessential Asian experience that I just did not have growing up. But I also know people who did go through those experiences, right? I have a friend who grew up in Indiana where like she would get embarrassed whenever her mom would bring out Asian snacks when her friends were over. And it's a very real thing that I've seen other people grapple with. And so, like, I wonder how much of that also leads to, you know, when you're told your whole life that you're not enough, that you need to fit in, you need to change yourself. That, what does that do to you, right?
Yeah. As someone who also grew up like in New Jersey, I don't have the same experience as Jane because I did grow up in a Korean American enclave. And even when we moved out of that enclave, there were still like enough Asians that we weren't alone. And this is actually like pretty interesting because my cousin asked me this recently. She said, as someone who lived in the East Coast and now lives in the West Coast, what would you say is the difference between like Asian Americans? And I told her, well, there's no reason to conform here on the West Coast because there's like such a diverse group of Asians. And you can really, you know, you have that security net of just like, okay, like I don't have to prove myself. Like there are slacker Asians, there are overachieving Asians, there are Asians who have dropped out of school to help out with family businesses. And then there are Asians who, you know, are making bank and are, you know, being lawyers and whatnot. And I feel like there is like this ease that you can move around in the world because you know you are so sure of your identity and you don't feel ashamed or you don't feel the need to make yourself small or you don't feel invisible. It's just you are allowed to exist.
Yeah.
Whereas on the East Coast, like even if you grow up in an enclave, let me tell you, like the Asians there are super intense. Okay. It is like competitiveness is like on another level. And I think there is like this idea of scarcity in the East Coast. Like there can only be one successful Asian in the writing community. There can only be a certain number of Asians who can make it to Columbia or Harvard. So you're kind of trained to see other Asians as your competition. And also like you are competing, you're trying to be at the level of the legacy kids. That's also your competition. So it's like you're constantly trying to prove yourself that, you know, you are worthy of being in these prestigious institutions, that you deserve that job on Wall Street and whatnot. So there is like a lot of like not self-loathing, but just like I need to show the world that I am the best. And like that energy is not in the West Coast.
Yeah, you need to prove that your hard work is worth just as much as their nepo baby bloodline, right?
Yeah, and I feel like in California, like there are so many nepo babies that like I feel like people are just like so used to it. They're like, of course, like why would we compete with the nepo babies here? Like it's kind of like useless. So wherever you end up, you end up.
I mean, that said, even having grown up in an enclave, you eventually do have to, you know, leave and brush up against the real world. And that's when you start to realize that, you know, white supremacy does exist. Like when you enter the professional world and suddenly you are the only Asian in the room, you know, this country, like America, likes to view itself as a place where anyone can make it. But the truth is, and this is something that is shown time and time again in during Jane's memoir, is like, but only if you fit into your box, the box that like we put you in. And you know, that's something that she runs into time and time again during her career of like pursuing writing. Which is why, like, again, going back to her Kundiman story, that was so such like, it's at the same time funny, but also sad, right? That like she would be so emotionally assaulted, like by seeing acceptance for the first time, right?
Yeah, there's this quote where she says, "Rage and solitude is one thing, rage and community is another. The latter is fertilizer, is transformative." And I think that is so true because, you know, like you and I have worked in like the Asian American like media spaces, and it's just like when something outrageous fucking happens, like when we see something on angryasianman.com and we're just like, that's some racist bullshit, like our community rallies, you know? But imagine if you are in freaking Iowa, like, or somewhere where there is like you're the only Asian person, you just simmer in that rage and you, I don't know, you feel like you're being gaslit. You're just like, oh, maybe you're overreacting. And it's like, oh, there's no point in feeling angry. Nothing's going to change. But when you're in a community, it's like, no, you can make a change.
It's the whole, it's the argument for representation, right? It just, which is like, there are other people who feel the same way you do. You're not alone. But when there's no one else to like kind of bounce that off of, like you do feel very alone. And you start to wonder, like, am I the baddie, right? Am I the one in the wrong? And that's just such a tough place to be. Now you're at this place, which is where you want to be, but you don't feel welcome.
Yeah. And there is a chapter where she talks about how she met Maxine Hong Kingston for the first time, the author of The Woman Warrior, which was a previous book club pick on the show. And she says that how starstruck she was by Maxine. And she was like very shy about getting a picture with her. And she wanted to say all these things to Maxine, like, oh, like, thank you for paving the way. Like, thank you for being one of the only Asian writers that I like had an example of, like a role model for. And even though she didn't say any of those things, like Maxine hugged her and she said, I did it for you, like I did it for the next generation. And it was all she needed to be like, okay, I have to keep writing because, you know, there is worth in it.
Yeah.
And like I think that's been one of the most rewarding things about doing this podcast for sure. Like starting from 2016 to now, we've just seen so many young and upcoming Asian American writers, and they have so many role models. Whereas, you know, the older writers, they really struggled and they really had to carve out a space for themselves. And now we have our own table and we side eye all the bullshit that happens, like the yellow face thing with Michael Derek Hudson, the guy who pretended to be a Chinese poet and made it into the best American like poetry collection. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Jane does include a lot of like real life, maybe not current events, but there's a lot of other works, other articles, histories. And I had kind of forgotten about that whole debacle before reading her thoughts about it in this novel. Like, oh yeah, that did happen, didn't it?
Yeah. And the most frustrating thing about that was we couldn't even celebrate the Asian American writers who did make it into the collection, like the real Asian American writers. And she was talking about how it was so like it made her feel so gross that her name was so close to this yellow faced guy's name in the table of contents, and how, you know, whenever she or the other Asian American writers who made it into this collection would have interviews, they would always ask them about the yellow face poet. and not really about their own work. And I'm like, oh, of course they would center the yellow face poet above like the actual Asian American poets.
Yeah.
And she talks about how, like, you know, how demeaning and how frustrating it is that, you know, the publishing industry would just mix up Asian writers for other Asian writers. You know, it's like, that's not like, oh, I didn't write that book. That was a different Asian author. It's like, oh, well, you guys all look the same. And, you know, we still have this problem on like book Twitter where people would tag the wrong author. And it's like, that's not the author who wrote that book.
Yeah, I think Jane definitely does a really good job illustrating the frustrations of being an Asian, especially Asian woman author. But in addition to learning about her romantic and professional, adventures, we also learn a lot about her childhood, like growing up in a working class restaurant family in Atlantic City. And I thought those chapters were really compelling as well, right? Like kind of reading her, you know, her relationships with her parents, you know, her father, like we mentioned, was addicted to gambling and walked out on the family and leaving her mother to kind of raise them on her own. And I really liked reading about the mother. I think Jane does a really good job, you know, in a lot of stories about immigrant families, it's easy to reduce the parents to like this force you have to overcome. But in her memoir, like her parents, especially her mother, is her own like fully fleshed, like human character. And I really like that she took the time to talk about her history and the reasons why she came here and what her hopes and dreams were.
Yeah. And I also love how she credits her mother for being a poet. She's like, no, my mother was the first poet in our family. Like she always came up with these quote unquote ancient Chinese sayings. And she would always talk in like these like metaphors and similes and riddles. And it's like, that's where I got my love for language from. And I love how her mother transforms after her father leaves, because her mom, like because of like cultural and patriarchal standards, she had to like stand by her husband like through his like problematic behaviors and through his addiction. And and you know, like she was trying her best to not be quote unquote difficult. But after Jane's father left, her mother is like, yeah, be difficult. Like, put yourself first and don't make other people feel like you deserve less. Like when Jane goes through her breakups, like her mom is like, go buy yourself flowers. Like you don't need any boyfriends except me. Mommy will be your boyfriend, except for the sexy stuff. We're not doing that. And yeah. Like there's like Jane's humor there for you. And I just love how her mom is, you know, she's an extrovert and she really blossoms into her own. And even though she is like post office worker and she's like working these grueling hours in the night shift, like she still has like so much life to her. And yeah, like it was just like so endearing to see how close she was to her mother and how like in between sections in the book, there's like wongmom.com where she's like getting like imaginary advice from like her mom. And what if her mom's advice was available to the world on the internet?
Yeah, well, like, if you turn really her clever. Mom into like a ChatGPT chatbot just to give like auntie isms to the common person.
And like with her father, I thought the opening essay, Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City, the titular essay, I liked how she gives context to the readers about how gambling is not just, you know, it's not just like an Asian American trait. It's not like a Chinese trait. She says that like Chinese people are targeted. Like they actually have buses that roll into Chinatown to get.
I mean, there's a reason why we call those Chinatown buses, right?
Yeah. And it's like you can't just boil it down to like, oh, Chinese people are into luck and into gambling. Like, no, they are being targeted. And they're being sold this dream that they can make it big and they can you know, be like, they can be lucky, and it's like they don't understand that the game is rigged. And it's kind of like the same with academia, you know, you're kind of sold this American dream and it's like, oh, it's kind of rigged. And
I mean, that's the deal with the American dream in general, right? It's like you're told that you can be anybody here. But again, the game is rigged. Like, you can be anyone as long as you're a certain type of person.
Yeah. And it did, like, reading about her brother trying to reach out to their dad and, like, build this relationship, it was really hard to read, because it's like, oh my god, like, you're giving someone so many chances who, like, don't really give that much value to you as, like, a person. The way that her brother, like, recorded all these NBA basketball games on VHS tapes.
Yeah, that was a sad story.
Because he knew that his dad didn't have a DVD player and he wanted to have this activity that they can both enjoy and bond over, but their dad is like, oh, I'm busy. And, you know, like, Jane being like, I was so furious in the car. I want to, like, freaking punch my dad in the face. But what is that going to do? It's just going to make things worse. And it's like, oh, another example of us just sitting in rage and
And that story was extra sad just because, you know, the way that her brother's portrayed in the story, like, she portrays him as someone who is much kinder than she is, that has a soft heart, although he does have a lot of rage as well. And she does reflect on, maybe that has something to do with the way that she raised him to, you know, be strong against the world. But I also wonder how much of their father's, like, neglect is out of his own shame too, for not being able to provide as the patriarch of this family, of not being able to play his role as father to his kids, husband to his wife, because he was the one that, you know, went back to get married, because that's what you're supposed to do as, like, a Chinese man. But I really like that Jane also put into context, like, the economic situation in China when her parents got married, right? Like, her mother grew up during the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward. And so it was not a great time to be in China. Like, there was a famine going on. And as much as we're critical about the American dream, moving to America as a wife provided her with the opportunity for economic mobility that she couldn't find in China, especially in the 80s, right? And at the very least, her being in America provided her the opportunity to find a life of her own after Jane's father left the family and after they had to close the restaurant. She was able to, you know, find a new career at the post office, which, you know, it's not the quote-unquote American dream, but it's enough to make a living. And, you know, government jobs, you know, their benefits are pretty nice.
And also,
right?
She finds, like, a family there too. She has, like, a great support network at the postal office. And, you know, like, it goes into, like, how community and support networks are so important. And they really help us find ourselves and find value in ourselves.
I really like the story where we learn that both Jane and her brother Stephen were named by customers to their Chinese restaurant because their mother wanted to give them American names but didn't know any.
I mean, that's kind of like what happened with my middle brother. He, like, immigration was like, oh, his name is too hard. Like, you should probably come up with a American name for him. How about Brian? And they're like, okay, yeah, like, we'll take it. It was literally the first name that was pitched to them and they just kind of latched onto it. And then with my baby brother, they had a list of American names, English names, because they're like, oh, it's the first person in our family who is being born in America, like an actual American-born Korean-American. And the names that they picked out for him was so bad, like, so freaking bad. They, like, one of the top three names that they had for him was Fred. And I'm
Fred.
Like, Fred. And I'm like, we are not white people. Okay. Like, hells no, my baby brother is not going to be named Fred or Bob or Bill.
You know, but I feel like those, like, classic white names I've only known to be Asians. And maybe that's just a product of where I grew up. But, you know, I have friends named Harry. I do have a friend named Fred. So, you know.
Ugh. Ugh. I mean, no offense to the Asian Freds out there, but Like, why? Just why? My brother should be very, like, he should be happy and relieved that I was the one who named him Eric. But that's neither here nor there. But we mentioned, like, you know, how America, even though the game is rigged, there is a little bit of wiggle room for upward mobility. Like, yeah, sure, you might not be, like, rich, but you might be able to make a better life for yourself. There is, like, a higher possibility than if you had stayed in the motherland. And there is a guilt to that for the second gen Asian Americans who, you know, have succeeded because of their parents, like, working long hours and undesirable jobs. But just because you have escaped poverty does not mean that poverty leaves you. Like, she talks about how, like, when she was a teenager, she would, like, she used to shoplift, and she, when she gets caught, she realizes that she's been shoplifting the only the sale items, only the clearance items. And she's like, oh, even as a thief, I'm a thrifty thief. I can't bury my my thrifty immigrant background. And it's the same thing now.
I related to that so hard, though, because, like, I too am, like, conditioned to only buy things that are on sale, even though I have, yeah, like, adult money now.
And it's the same thing with food, right? It's like, you, like, a lot of our parents and grandparents, they grew up in a time when food was scarce. And it's like, you have to eat everything off of your, like, you have to eat everything that is offered to you. But when you're, like, second gen and you're successful and you have, like, all these doors open to you, like, you feel bad when you don't finish your plate. You feel bad saying no to an opportunity.
Yeah. Speaking of food, Jane's memoir also reminded me of the, it was, like, recent, too, like, within the last 5 years, that incident of, like, hey, I made congee better for the American palate.
Oh, yeah, she does mention that in the book about that white lady, yeah, who's like, I rediscovered congee. And it's like, rediscovered, like, lady, like, congee has been eaten for, like, centuries in China and in, like, other Asian countries. Yeah. Like,
and I thought it was interesting that she calls it juk, which I know in Chinese it's so, but juk is Korean, right? That's Korean.
Yeah, juk is Korean. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, it was funny because, like, as I was reading that passage, my mother-in-law upstairs was making congee. So, like, I was smelling, it was a very interesting multimedia moment for me, like, reading that passage.
I love the passages where she is talking about how much she hates the word elevate in food cuisine, like, yeah, in, like, cooking. And she's like, what is, like, what, when they mean elevating Asian food, they mean that Asian food, immigrant food, is cheap, dirty, not worth paying a large sum of money for. And it can only be colonized and, quote unquote, elevated to a respectable level if only, like, a white person takes this old recipe and makes it Western. And it's like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting conversation that I'm personally interested in as well, because, like, is the same if, like, it was an Asian chef who, you know, is recreating dishes from their childhood and, you know, putting...
It still,
like,
makes me feel weird.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, in LA, this is especially salient because we're a city with a huge, diverse ethnic food culture. But we're also the city where, if you're on the West Side, where your clientele is a lot less diverse, let's say, it's not uncommon to see someone make a bowl of pho and charge, like, $20 for it, right? And on one hand, you can say, well, that's how much people there are willing to pay for good food. But on the other hand, like, what does it say about us that, like, you can only charge this much once your food is acknowledged by, like, white people?
Yeah, and also brings into question, like, what is considered authentic Asian food, you know? Like, just because, like, for example, Chinese American food, orange chicken, that's not, like, that's not a motherland food, but who's to say that that is less authentic? It was made by the enclave here. So doesn't that have the same merit as Chinese cuisine in the motherland? So she does bring up a lot of, like, good points. And I do love the righteous anger that's kind of thrumming
through her essays. And I'm like, yeah. Yes, this anger, this... Like, I feel like I'm always angry, and I don't know if it's because I'm a woman or if like I'm also like Asian American living in like a white man's world. But
I think all of the above is the same anger that Jane obviously has as well. One of my favorite essays is, I believe it's the second full essay, is the one about dentistry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was like such a cool essay because I did not know about these illegal dentistry places. In Chinatown.
I've always went to like, I mean, I went to a Chinese dentist, but I think they were a legit dentist. Like, I didn't go to like these, like, we definitely use insurance and not like these under the table backdoor payments. But I think it was a really good point that she makes, which is like dental care. Yeah. Dental care is like a sign of affluence,
prosperity.
Right?
Yeah. Like she talks about how like her mother's village, like they would have to travel to not even a city, but like another town that's like hours away just to see a doctor. And the doctor is not even like a licensed doctor. It's someone who has like some medical knowledge, but not like a license. And it was only like later on in Chinese history where they started to get like dental schools up and running and like medical programs up and running. And I always knew that like dentistry was like a sign of privilege because I know people who couldn't get like braces when they were younger, but like that was kind of like the extent of it. Like in my mind, it's like, oh, you couldn't get your teeth fixed, but there's like another layer to it where it's like, yeah. Oh, you can't even afford to go to a doctor, to a dentist for a checkup. Like they're like prying open. They're like taking out teeth from your mouth because they can't fix a cavity. Like that was something that was really eye-opening to me.
Yeah, and it really put into perspective some of the things that I, you know, grew up with. Like my grandparents, my grandma especially, had false teeth growing up, and I never really thought about it as like her not having access to dental care when she was a kid, but that was probably the case because, you know, like dental care is something that we kind of take granted here in the States because, you know, dentists are plentiful, but it can be prohibitively expensive if you don't have insurance, right?
Any medical care in America is expensive if you don't have insurance, which is why a lot of immigrant and poor families, they are so scared to go to the ER. You know, they're like, we can't afford to pay like the copay or whatever. And it's... you know, a level of privilege that, you know, people in middle class don't really think about. Because it's like, of course, if you don't have insurance, you're going to pay whatever fee that they're asking you to pay. But a couple hundred dollars, it means something different to like a poor class.
Yeah, I really enjoy it because in that essay, she not only talks about like this very real thing that occurs in like immigrant communities, but also just really puts in perspective like what dental care means. And like for some people, that is the American dream, right? To have like great teeth that's your own.
And it's not even just like dentistry. It's also like optometry. Like glass, like let me just say, as someone who has very bad vision and requires like corrective lenses, I would be severely disabled in a world where glasses did not exist. And in a lot of rural areas, like they don't have an optometrist. They don't have funds to get glasses. And that's something that we don't really even think about in like the first world countries. Cause it's like, yeah, you can't see, just get glasses.
Yeah. Oh, I guess the last thing I kind of want to talk about is just my favorite part in the book was reading about the family coming to like one of her early shows and just like being like proud but unimpressed. And I feel like that's such a, in my mind at least, quintessential like Asian creative experience, right? To have your family come and like acknowledge that you did something good, but not really understanding what you actually did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's like an Asian family thing. Because I feel like there's a lot of families out there of all races who are just like, I have no idea what this creative thing that my my kid is doing, but as long as they're happy, I guess, like, I'm proud of them.
Yeah.
I do love the ending of the book, the last essay that she has, and it's the one with her mother and her eating mangoes, mm-hmm. like, on her day off. And she goes into the history of mangoes in China, like, how it was introduced, like, during, like, Chairman Mao's time, and how it just, like, had, like, how there was, like, this cult for mangoes because, like, for the first time ever, Chinese people were able to eat it. And I was like, huh, that's another thing, like, fruits being a sign of privilege, which is probably why, like, in a lot of, like, Asian households, fruits are, like, considered very precious because it's a sign of prosperity. Like, you actually have money and resources to eat fresh fruit. And yeah. I thought it was really sweet that, like, her mother would be like, sorry, I can't take any shifts today. I'm going to just eat a box of mangoes with my daughter. And it's like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, it definitely ends on a hopeful note, right? Like, the final line is her stating that she's not done yet. She's going to continue writing. And, you know, I'm excited for that because, like, we talked about this at the top of the show, but her writing is just really evocative. And, like, for me, it was just, it was such a joy to read, and I'm excited to see what else comes from her, like whether it's, you know, more poetry or something more narrative.
Yeah, I would say this is like a very emotional book. It really does like tug at your heartstrings and really makes you reflect on your own privileges and on your own experiences and just like all the frustrating things in the world, all the ceilings, all the blockades. As someone who is a writer, I really, you know, I really appreciated her talking about how there were days where she just could not write anything. And like how in the pandemic, it was just so hard for her to stay, to have like any motivation. And, you know, she doesn't say it like outright, but it was like she needed that break to really like, she just needed that break to feel at peace. And I love how she found peace through cooking, through gardening. And it really sounded like she is a very nurturing professor to her students. And she is really trying hard to break the cycle of really bad professors who are giving like horrible advice and are pretty much borderline abusive to their students. Like she's really trying to help her students like feel things and connect through their writing. And I was like, okay, that's so rare. And this is why it's so important to have like BIPOC creatives in like higher positions and in universities and academia. So I was like, there's hope. For the next generation. It's really hard to cling to that because the world is terrible, but there is hope.
People are out there fighting the good fight. We just need to, you know, we need more of them, and we need them to be recognized and nurtured. We did have a comment on our Discord by our book club member Catherine, who wrote, I really enjoyed this memoir. I haven't read any of Jane's work before, but when she said her background was in poetry, I thought it makes sense. Her writing to me was very fluid and always has a hint of sadness, even when describing happy moments. Her relationship with men were devastating for me to read. I know there are men like this, and I hate how they are able to seek out women like Jane. She seems to have a healthier relationship with herself now, and hopefully that will translate to a love well-deserved. I love Jin Ai. Jane's mom is someone I would like to get a drink with. Their relationship was so warm and non-judgmental and loving. It was empowering for me to read about an older Asian woman be so herself and give no fucks. Yes, her credit spending isn't the best, but as it's said in the book, it's the American dream, right? Get everything you want, everything can be yours. Most memoirs are raw and give me subjects to think about, but this one made an impression on me. I don't know if it's the intergenerational trauma that she links to food or her imposter syndrome, the microaggressions, or all of it. But through these pages, it felt like a conversation, and I really can't understand Jane and why she wanted to write this book.
Yeah, I definitely agree with a lot of points that Catherine brought up. And I feel like this is a book that really is, I don't know, like, it really makes you feel. I don't know how else to describe it, but it, like, the prose is very sensory. So it really makes you focus on like the moment and what sentences that you are reading. It's like very immediate. I honestly cannot describe it other than those like poor words that I just said.
Yeah, like you feel the things that she feels. You feel like you feel happy for her when she's happy. You feel sad for her when she's sad. You feel angry for her when she is, you know, dealing with all the crap that she dealt with. And she's dealt with a lot of crap. So.
Yeah. I mean, this book kind of reminded me of The Magical Language of Others by E.J. Coe, which is another memoir that we've read for this book club. For that book, like, E.J. is also a poet, so her prose is also, like, very visceral, very, like, very beautiful and lyrical. But that memoir made me feel things that I didn't want to feel. Like, it was way too close to, like, my own feelings and my own trauma. And, of course, like, we need books like that that makes you really re-examine, like, the things that you went through in your life. But, I don't know, Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City, like, it was nice to read a memoir that was emotional, but also didn't freaking attack me.
I'm sure someone out there felt
I'm pretty sure
by
someone
book.
Out there had the same, you know, had the same experience that I did with Magical Language of Others. But yeah, it was nice to have a little bit of distance from the writer's experience in a memoir.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I guess that'll do it for our discussion of Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City. We didn't really talk much about the Atlantic City part of it, huh?
Well, that's like only in the first essay, which is why I say it's like reverse Uno card, you know? It's like you think that it's going to go really into like the family being abandoned and just like the crippling debt that they're left with. But it's not just that. It really goes into other aspects of Jane's life, which is what made it such an interesting read.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you have any thoughts you'd like to share about the book, please let us know either on Discord or on our Goodreads forums. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback on the books that we've read and our discussion of it as well. So before we call an episode, let's find out what book we're reading for book club for February. And for this month, it's my turn to pick. And since February is a shorter month, the book I've chosen this month is a novella. It's Untethered Sky by Fonda Lee, which is a fantasy story about a girl named Esther who goes on a quest to hunt down the manticore that killed her family by training with a roc, which is a giant bird from Middle Eastern folklore. So it's a story about a girl, her giant bird, a monster, and revenge. And I'm really excited to read this book. Fonda Lee is the author of one of my favorite series, The Greenbone Saga, Jade City, Jade War, and Jade Legacy. And if there's one thing she knows how to do really well is write great fantasy action. So I'm excited to get into this book with all of you.
And it is only 152 pages. So quite a short book.
Yeah. So hope you all read along with us. As always, if you finish the book, please let us know your thoughts on our Goodreads forums or our Discord. As you heard, we'd love to include the feedback from our listeners in our podcast episodes whenever possible. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for joining us for our discussion of Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City by Jane Wong. And I guess happy February. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see y'all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.